All right, looks like we're recording. This is Roger Early Pryor with the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Today is September 11th, 2017, and we're conducting an oral history, oral future interview with Ms. Rashida Phillips. Rashida, can you tell me when you were born?
April 6, 1984.
And where were you born?
I was born in Trenton, New Jersey, about 45 minutes from Philadelphia.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about your family, the family you were born into?
Sure. I was born to a young mother. My mom had me when she was 14. And so was born to a teen parent. Didn't really know my father growing up. We lived with my grandmother and grandfather and my mother's brother and sister for my early years. And then my mom got married eventually and we moved out, and it was myself, my mother, and at the time one brother growing up, and then eventually I got two more little brothers. So I have three younger brothers. I'm the oldest, and a lot of my immediate family still lives in New Jersey, but my mother and my younger brothers all now live in Atlanta.
So. Cool. What brought them down to Atlanta?
First, we moved to Philly, and we were the first people, my mom and myself and my younger brothers were the first people from my family to sort of leave New Jersey. And then we lived in Philly for a while, a few years, and then my mom got hurt and is essentially disabled. She had a stroke and some other things happened, and so had to stop working. And then my grandmother actually moved to Virginia a while back. She retired and moved to Virginia, and so my mom moved and was closer to her in Virginia, and then eventually moved to Atlanta because it was just cheaper for her to live down there. And yeah, we have some of our other family is from Georgia, so
okay,
she kind of wanted to be closer to her, yeah, her father's family.
Family networks.
Yeah.
So. Nice. When did you move from Trenton to Philly?
We moved here when I was 14. When I was 14.
So you spent your childhood really in Trenton?
Yeah, I spent my childhood kind of in Trenton and Princeton. We lived in Princeton, New Jersey for a while. But yeah, between Trenton and Princeton. And then we moved to Pennsylvania when I was 14. We moved to Pennsylvania a little bit earlier than that. We lived in Marsville, Pennsylvania, which is like right next to Trenton. It's like 2 minutes from Trenton. And then moved to Philly when I was 14. So lived in Pennsylvania for a couple of years and then moved to Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about some of your memories of childhood.
Any specific memories?
Whatever comes to mind, something you enjoyed, something that was impactful, something, those sort of things.
I think my earlier memories from childhood are good. Much before I turned maybe 7 or 8, I was only child for a while. I have always been a reader. I've always loved books. That's just always been my thing. I was the type of child that would be in the house reading over like being outside or being at the playground. I've always enjoyed science fiction. I think from the time I was in, even back in kindergarten, I can remember reading like little sci-fi stories and being interested in that and writing my own story. So I was always a writer, always interested in like writing plays and theater and sci-fi and all of that stuff. And then I guess maybe around the time that I turned 7 or 8 is my mom had my brother, the brother that's right underneath me, and at that time we kind of started moving around a lot. We moved to Princeton around that time, which was a really difficult experience for me. I think that was probably the first time I ever experienced racism and classism and those sorts of things, and that kind of informed me in a lot of ways and informed a lot of my experiences after that point, because maybe around the time I was 9 or 10, my mom and stepdad got divorced, and I moved back to Trenton, which was also a difficult experience because I had been coming from this, like, particular education system. By the time, you know, when I lived in Princeton, I went to very good schools. And so coming back to Trenton, which in a lot of ways, the school system and the place itself is like Philadelphia, but much smaller, more compressed. There's a
lot. What do you mean by that?
Just in terms of like things like poverty, violence, the symptoms of poverty. There's a lot of similarities between Trenton and Philadelphia. But Trenton being way smaller than Philadelphia, it's like you feel it a little bit more. Things are a lot closer together, and so things feel compounded, or at least they felt that way to me as a child, and looking back and thinking about that and integrating that into my experience now. So I don't have, like, great memories of that time and experience in my childhood. I returned to Trenton after Princeton, and Trenton had a lot of violence still to this day, very violent place just because there's a lot of gangs there. Like I said, a lot of poverty, which compounds a lot of these issues, housing crisis, things like that. Although I have always had, for the most part, a stable living situation, because my mother, you know, was at a point a single mom having to take care of, at the time, two kids and then eventually four kids. She was, like, never home, so I was often home by myself. I'd often say I raised myself for a while. I was definitely a latchkey kid. I also got into drugs and sex and all sorts of just bad things, around that time in my life. And then
I think around when you're 10, 11?
Yeah, around the time I was 10 and 11. I had experiences of sexual violence, all sorts of things happening. I ran away, got put in a boot camp, all sorts of things happening. And then we moved to Philadelphia. And the reason we moved to Philadelphia is because it was actually kind of by chance. My aunt had gotten into, like, a really bad accident, car accident in Philadelphia, and so my mom, in coming up to visit her, kind of, like, saw, and she was in the Northeast, and so saw the Northeast and was like, oh, this looks like a nice place to live and buy a house. And so my mom bought her first house in Philadelphia, and that's that was part of the reason why we moved. But as soon as I moved to Philadelphia when I was 14, I got pregnant. So then that was a whole other saga of life.
Before we move into that saga, can we revisit some of the other stuff?
Sure.
Fascinated, too, but that you've always been a writer and a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember some of the stories you used to write about?
Yeah.
Were they influenced by a lot of what you were seeing in Trenton, particularly?
Well, when I was younger, no. Well, a little bit. I mean, when I was really young, like 5 or 6, a lot of what I was writing was modeled off of stuff that I was reading. So, like, there was this play, I think it was The Red Hen or The Sky as well.
I
think it was Chicken Little. Like, I loved that play so much, and I would just, like, write my own version of it and then, like, put on productions for my family in, like, the living room and stuff. So that kind of stuff. When I got a little bit older, like maybe 7 or 8 or 9, I started reading stories like Christopher Pike, who's a sci-fi writer, and also stories like My Teacher's an Alien, I can't remember, Bruce Colville books. I really liked Roald Dahl, stuff like that we were, like, reading in class, but I would, like, write my own stories that were, like, modeled off of that. So, like, My Teacher is an Alien series, I wrote my own My Teacher is an Alien series where I was, like, turned into a Barbie. Like, those kind of stories. It was just, yeah, they were cool.
Who was introducing you to some of those stories?
Teachers, school. Yeah, we read a lot of stuff in school that I can recall. But also my mom was, like, really supportive of the fact that I love to read, so she would buy me books. Every time I went to, like, Walmart or something like that, I would get a book, or if I would go to visit my aunt, she would take me somewhere and get a Barnes & Noble's. Like, that would be, like, some of my favorite trips of just, like, going to visit my aunt, going to Barnes & Noble's, getting to pick out a book, her buying me rice pudding because that was my favorite dessert, and like sitting in a corner under a blanket reading my book and eating rice pudding. Like that was the best time.
That was happy space.
That was happy space.
Yeah.
When I became a teenager, my writing became darker and was more so modeled off of what was happening around me and also like books that I was reading. So I started for maybe when I was 13 or 14 reading like urban novels, and there was this really popular novel out at the time called Fly Girl by a Philly author named Tyrone. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but Fly Girl was like when the urban novel first kind of emerged as a thing. It was like one of the first ones.
Tell me, what do you mean by urban novel?
Novels written by usually African-American people, black people, that are like about the urban experience. Some type of fiction novel that's like a murder mystery but set in like the hood. You know, it's about the urban experience. And that novel in particular, Fly Girl, was about this, it was a story about this teenager, and you sort of went through her life and her growing up and just like the influence. It was also like based in like the 80s and it was in Philly, and so you kind of just got this sense of what was happening for this person in the 80s. It was a really, really great novel. But that influenced my writing and like influenced me to, and like I wrote this story when I was 14, I think, about this girl getting pregnant. Who lived in Trenton, and then I got pregnant like a couple months later.
You hadn't yet got pregnant.
When I wrote that. So it was like very, almost, for me, it felt a little prophetic, and like, in looking back, it reaffirms this like notion of being able to write something into existence, whether it's bad or good, because that very much mirrored what would become my own experiences. Mm. So,
when you moved back to Trenton, and especially when around the time you turned around 10 in those years right afterwards, what was going on that in that world that drew you into those experiences? Were you searching for something else, or that just happened to be around you and you fell into it?
I think it was just happened to be around me and I fell into it. You know, I guess my mom is young. She had me at a very young age. My aunt and uncle were young. And so just like my influences, I just had a bunch of younger people in my life. It's not like my mom was like 30. She was like literally in her 20s, you know, and just also growing up. And so she was never home. She worked three jobs to try to take care of me and my brothers. And so the people who were watching me was like my aunt and my uncle, who were like 16 and 17, and they're also getting into their own stuff. And you know, my uncle was at the time, he might have been selling drugs, and you know, there was just a lot of things around me. And also, like I said, there was a lot of gang violence, and pretty much everyone I knew was in a gang, so that was also a lot of the things that were going on around me. Yeah, some of that stuff.
Yeah, when you became pregnant at 14, you said,
yeah.
What were your thoughts? What were your feelings? What was going on for you then?
So many things. A lot of things. It was really crazy stuff when I look back. Part of it was just interesting, like, pressure of, like, me being seen as the person who has to make it and break the family cycle and be the first person to go to college, because I was the first person in my family to go to college. You know, and that had always been the expectation for me. And so to disappoint that was a really big deal for me. But also, I feel like I also rebelled against that in a way, and so that also played a role in me becoming pregnant. It was like this rebellion that I wasn't fully conscious of and didn't really understand what I was doing, to be honest. Part of me also thought that having a child might be a way to get attention or to have something that I felt at the time was missing. I had one of my best friends had a baby, right, maybe a year before I got pregnant, and so just like watching what happened with her, I guess I was curious about what it would be like, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, some of those things, and also I think also probably the thought that it's not going to happen to me, you know, I don't need to be as careful, I'm not my mom, you know, those sorts of things.
The expectations you talked about were set for you. Where were those expectations coming from for you?
Definitely my mom and my grandmother. Yeah, definitely those, mainly those two. And I think just in general from my family, I mean, I had a lot of experiences that my mother didn't get to have. Like, when I was 14, actually, when I was maybe like 3 or 4 weeks pregnant, I didn't know it. My mom had worked really, really hard to get me into this program where I was able to travel to a different country, to 5 different countries.
Wow.
It was called something, but I was like some type of student ambassador. And you had to pay a shitload of money. It was like my mom had to like raise like $5,000 or something.
Wow.
To send me to pay for like the plane tickets and stuff. And she just really completely like went in. She got me an article in a newspaper so people could donate. And it was really amazing. But anyway, so I have been sent on that trip, and I got to visit London, France, Belgium. I stayed with a family in Germany. It was just like this really amazing experience.
Yeah.
But just things like that was like, I was always smart. I always had good grades. They wanted to like skip me, and when I was in kindergarten, I could read, or, you know, it was just all of these things like, you're the person who's going to get us out of, you know, whatever. And not like my family was just down and out. I mean, we've always been low income, but not poor. Like I said, I always had a roof over my head. Whether it was with my mom or with my grandmother. My grandmother was a teacher, but she also had my mom at a young age. She had my mom at 17, and my aunt was also a young mother. And so it was just this family cycle that it was expected that I was not going to fall into that cycle, but I did. So that's kind of where the pressure was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk to me about being pregnant at 14. I mean, what was going through your mind about what you wanted at that point? Was it just, was it like, well, this is just normal?
No. It was terrible. It was a really scary experience because I would say, you know, I also had expectations for myself. Like, it's not like I didn't want to go to college. I enjoyed school. I enjoyed writing. I had aspirations. But at the same time, even with my aspirations, I think they were limited in a lot of ways because I didn't know, for example, that I could go grow up and be an author or be a, you know, I didn't have these, like, I knew I needed to go to college, but I didn't think of myself as someone who could come grow up and be a sci-fi writer or be able to publish, you know. So, but still, you know, I didn't understand what it meant to be pregnant, and it was a really terrifying and horrible experience because when it happened, it was also, I had just moved to a new city. I was starting high school. It was all of these life changes happening at one time. And so it was really terrifying. I was switching schools also. I was going from this school district out in Marsville, which is like one of the best school districts in the state, to Philadelphia, which is a whole different ball game. I was also a very high-risk pregnancy, so I had a very difficult pregnancy. I was hospitalized a couple times. My child actually was born premature, 2 months premature.
Wow.
So it was just a really difficult experience for me, on top of just, like, the pressures of and the stereotypes of being, you know, walking around with a belly and how people look at you, how people treat you, how people talk to you. My teachers literally telling me I'm going to drop out, I'm not going to make it. It's really bad stuff.
But you got through all that. How? What was it?
Easily get through it. I struggled. I fell. You know, I got very depressed after I had my child. and for, I'll back up and just say that, like, when I first got pregnant, I originally intended to give my child up for adoption, but my mom, who at the time worked in social services and worked in Trenton at the Department of Human Services, they call it DIFAS out in Trenton, but here it's known as DHS, and she worked with foster youth and worked at a youth home and was like, you're not giving your child up for adoption, that's not an option. And I didn't feel like I wanted to experience an abortion. I just didn't want to go through that. So I decided to keep the child, but did not know what that meant or what that would bring. And, you know, sort of watching my mom struggle to raise me and my brothers, it became extremely scary. So, yeah, high school was difficult. My first year after I had my child, I went through a very heavy depression. I became suicidal. I tried to take my life when my child was maybe a couple months old. But fortunately, I had a boyfriend at the time who was there with me and took me to the hospital. So I went through, so there's a hospital here called Friends, which is up in the Northeast. Not Friends, is it called Friends? But I stayed in the hospital for maybe a week or so, and that is, to be honest, the thing that really brought me out of, not brought me out of depression, but gave me clarity around what I needed to do and how I needed to move forward.
What happened there then?
I think, so I was there for about a week, and part of what happened was that I saw other people who had way worse issues than I could ever have, you know, despite, you know, and I say that kind of with, you know, not to diminish my own issues and not to diminish what I was going through and my own experiences that brought me to that point, but I just, it allowed me to assess what I had and how I could move forward and how I was not in a place of no return. And then my mom came up to visit me and bought my child. And that, like, it, I don't know, seeing my child and being where I was and not being able to, like, go home with her, and that just, it did something to me and brought me back a little bit, I think. So when I got out of there, you know, it, I think it was probably close to like the end of the school year. Somehow I got through the school year. I took the summer and got myself together, and then I just came back ready to go. And it, fortunately, so I spent part of my 10th grade year at this one school. And then my mom, then we moved and I got transferred to another high school, and that also helped because the high school I was at was just not good.
What was the first school?
So the first school was the Northeast High School, and then I switched to Lincoln High School.
What was different about Lincoln?
So Northeast had a lot of racial tension issues. There was a lot of race wars there. Kind of, not anything that I was caught up in, but just a lot of racial tension. Also, my child's father, who I was not in a relationship with, went to the school. And so when I started there as a ninth grader, pregnant by some boy that I'm not even really involved in and who's involved with other people, then there was rumors and just other things that made it really difficult for me to just be normal. And so going to a different school just was like a fresh start for me. And I just did so much better academically. And also, like I said, at the Northeast High School, when I first started there, the teachers were terrible, terrible, just the way that they talked to me. And it's funny, actually, one of the teachers who had said something to me, like, you're not going to make it or you're going to drop out, emailed me, like, years later and was like, I apologize for that, and I'm very proud of you. But, like, it's bullshit that you ever would, yeah, you know, but, yeah.
You so. Also talked about, as a child, you said around like eight or so, moving back to Trenton, was it?
Yeah.
Where you, was some of the first experience you had of racism. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I would say that moving to Princeton was like some of my first experiences of racism, where I was told things by other kids like, oh, black people can't read. You know, it was the first time I heard something like that. And other things. So that was like kind of my first experience of racism there.
How did that influence you and the path that you took?
I think it made me just very aware at an early age of what racism is and how it manifests itself, and in a way that, you know, because living in Trenton, I was around 98% black people and people of color, and then going from there to a place that was 98% white people, just really made me aware of myself and my place. And then I think that became compounded when I moved back to Trenton, because a lot of the cultural nuances, things like how you talk, you know, I got teased for stuff like that, like, oh, you talk like a white person, or, oh, you act like a white person, or just asserting yourself as intelligent is seen, you know, in that context of, in a cultural context, in a culture where, you know, now I can understand what that means. I can understand how, you know, things, what it means for someone to think that you talk white, and how, you know, just how that sort of thing is ingrained and indoctrinated in oppressed, you know, in an oppressed community. But at the time, I, of course, didn't understand what that meant, and I didn't understand what it meant to talk white, or, you know, just things like that, or just, like, a lot of other racial messaging that I got around, like, my lips being too big, or my nose being too wide, you know, just these things, because also, my family, my mother's sister, and brother, my mom and her siblings have different fathers. And so my mother's sibling's father is mixed with white. And so they have, so there's white in the family in that sense. And so, like, my aunt and my uncle used to tease me, and say my lips are too big, or my hair is too nappy, or these sorts of things. These experiences that, again, made me sort of aware at a young age, although it would take me many years to understand what it all meant and to, you know, undo some of that oppressive messaging for myself and how it affected my own self-esteem. At the time, yeah, it definitely did something to me. Yeah.
When was the time where you were able to start working through some of that? Not just in an emotional sense, but really kind of mixing the emotions with that sort of broader cultural sort of knowledge, you know, like the sort of informed, this is how to understand why this is happening, or why I was teased in these ways that shouldn't be there.
Right. It took me going to college, honestly, to start to undo a lot of that racial messaging. So I went to Temple University for undergrad, and law school. But in undergrad, I was able to take a lot of African American studies courses, and that's where it happened. That's where I was unindoctrinated, and where I began to understand all of this stuff. You know, I have that experience to thank. Yeah.
Before getting to Temple, that from being early high school, starting high school, being a new mom. How did you get through all of that? I mean, what was going on is the drive for you.
Mm-hmm. A lot of my drive, to be honest, was wanting to undo the cycle. You know, I watched my mom. I watched her struggle. I watched her have 3 more children and have to struggle to feed us. And then, you know, then for me to have my own child into the mix and to still be young and still have to rely on my mother. I didn't want that for myself, and I didn't want that for my child. I didn't want my child to have to grow up wondering where I'm at and how come, you know, regardless of the fact that, you know, my mom had to work. I didn't understand that at the time, or I didn't understand why she wasn't there for me when I needed her. You know, I'm only just now, maybe a couple years ago, getting to a place where I'm like, okay, this is what happened. But I knew then that I didn't want that for my child. I knew then that I didn't want my child to have the childhood that I had, and to have to experience the things that I had to experience. I wanted to be able to teach my child and steer them. I wanted to start a new tradition for my own family where education was valued and important, and not that it wasn't valued for my mother. She just didn't have the opportunities, you know, and I had to grow up hearing her say, I wanted to be a nurse or I wanted to be a doctor, and she never had an opportunity to be able to do that. So I wanted my child to have whatever choices, you know, and possibilities there were. I didn't want my child to have to be limited, you know, and to not have to go through what I went through, where I thought I can't be something, or I can't be a writer, or I can't be a creator. I never wanted my child to have to think or ask that. So that was my main motivation. Yeah, that was my main motivation.
What role did the art and visioning of storytelling play for you in that time in high school?
It didn't. And I say this all the time, I really put aside any creative stuff and I really just focused in and saw high school and raising my child as a 24-hour job, and I really threw myself into that, and which is why I think I was able to get through it and get scholarships and get out. So I really, I was not creative during those times of my life. I would say, though, that I had teachers and people in my life in high school who recognized that I had talent and creativity and pushed me in a lot of ways to bring that out in different ways. And so, like, my English teacher, for example, when I was in, like, 11th grade, was like, oh, you can write. Wow. You know, and would have me doing some creative stuff or just, like, really push me to, like, just show that or bring that out. And so I found different ways to, like, be creative in high school through my work, but I wasn't writing stories or doing anything specific.
When did that come back?
Didn't come back until after law school.
Really?
And I started here, actually. Yeah, it didn't come back. Sorry, one second. Sorry, go ahead. What was you saying?
When the creativity came back, it was really focused on getting through Temple and then getting through Temple Law School. That was,
yeah.
And being a full-time mom.
Exactly. Yeah, so I really didn't have an opportunity to start writing my own stories and getting back into my creative side until after I got through law school and literally started working here. Mm-hmm.
Why law school? Undergrad, it was a... What program were you doing?
I majored in criminal justice in undergrad. So why law school? The reason why law school is because when I was in high school, I had a teacher who... So I'll back up a little bit. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even really thinking about college seriously in high school after I had my child, because I was thinking I need to work. I don't know what I'm going to do. I need to work. Maybe I can go to college. How am I going to afford it? And then I had to take the PSATs. We had to take it, I think, for some whatever reason, the practice SATs. And my score was really good. And then, so some teacher was a counselor also at Lincoln was like, actually your scores are great, you should think about college, and just started kind of mentoring me from there. So it was kind of just like by chance that I did well on this test and somebody noticed me. But from there, and so that counselor, his name was Mr. Franklin, had a son who went to Temple Law School, and did his undergrad in like 2 or 3 years, went like straight through and then went to law school, and his picture was in like this book in a Temple Law publication or whatever, and he showed me that and I was like, wow, that's amazing. And that really like kind of sparked me, you know. It's just funny to think about that, like those little things.
Yeah.
Is what kind of pushes you to do something that you might not have otherwise have done. So I started thinking about law school because I was like, well, what else am I going to do? How else am I going to be able to take care of my child? What's a job that I can do or a career that's going to guarantee me that I'm able to take care of my child and not have to work 3 jobs to do it. And so really, like, I just thought, like, law school is one of the few choices. I didn't want to be a social worker because my mom was kind of a social worker and didn't seem like, you know, it was going to put me in that position that I wanted to be in. Again, I wasn't thinking that I could be some type of artist or creator. I just didn't think it, you know, it was possible for me. And I didn't think I had any other talents or any other thing. So I was like, oh, law school, anybody can do, probably do law school. And I was also very much influenced by, like, X-Files and, like, Law and Order. And I'm just thinking that I'm going to be able to, like, get a law degree and open the X-Files. Like, you know, that was kind of my thinking, as silly as it was. So yeah, that's what influenced me to go to law school.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because when I got into undergrad, started going to Temple, started taking all these really interesting classes in African American studies and sociology and philosophy and Greek literature, you know, all of these really cool classes. I'm like, oh, there's actually way more things I could do or think about doing with myself and way more things that I'm interested in than this weird law path. But at the time, because I had been successful in high school in spite of being a teen parent and I had applied for all these scholarships and gotten them and graduated with a pretty good GPA, there was like some spotlight on me. So the Philadelphia Inquirer did a couple stories on me. Like, it kind of followed me through high school and through college. And then because of that series of stories, I had a lot of people, like, tuned into my story, writing to me, cheering me on. People sometimes sent me money, all of these things. And so I felt this, like, immense pressure to go to law school because I was like, people are going to be really disappointed in me if I don't do what I said I'm going to do, even though I didn't want to go to law school anymore. So that's how I ended up in law school.
Wow. When you look back on that, do you think you'd do it differently?
No.
Why?
I don't think I should do it differently if I had a chance. Because I'm here where I am, and I think my life is not perfect, but it has come full circle in a way that feels necessary and feels like it shouldn't have happened any other way. I mean, of course, everybody, there's things I could change. I mean, obviously, my child growing up with a young mother, even though I was pretty cool and did okay, you know, it's not the best circumstances ever for a child, you know, obviously, but somehow we did it, and my kid's in college now, so I'm like, you know, I can't think of anything I should change. But I'm also, you know, I consider myself a light expert in time travel. So my... my imagination of what would happen if I were to go back into time and undo something is not this, like, crazy thing. I don't think I would rip space-time. It might just open up another parallel universe that's already in existence where something else different has happened, and I'm content with that universe staying there, and I'll just live this one out.
This is a good one for now.
Yeah.
I like it. Tell me about where you work now. What's the name of it?
So I work at Community Legal Services of Philadelphia.
And what kind of work do you do for them here?
I am currently the managing attorney of the housing unit, and I run a staff of currently 8 people, 9 people, which is 5 attorneys, 4 paralegals, and we provide legal advice to low-income Philadelphians who are facing issues with their rental housing, as well as work on a national, state, and local level on policy issues involving affordable housing and other things.
I'm struck by that your mother was a very young mother when she had you, and you felt a lot of pressures not to do that, and that then that happened, and your mother worked in social services, and initially you were like, I don't want to do that. I'm going to do something different. And yet the work you're doing, although it was very much your own path, is similar in some ways.
Yeah.
What's going on with that?
I have reflected on that. I reflected on that recently because I was in Atlanta visiting my mom. And she was saying something about how she, like, volunteers at a domestic violence hotline. I'm like, Mom, we actually do the same stuff. Like, we are very interested in the same things. And I hadn't reflected on that before because I just have not had a close relationship with my mother for a lot of reasons. But now I'm in a place where I can reflect and be like, you know what? We're very similar in our paths and our interests. And she obviously had a huge influence on me unconsciously in how she cares for people and how it's just natural for her to care for people. Like, she was always the person who, you know, took somebody's kid in if they're out in the street or whatever, even if she wasn't home. All, you know, she always has had a huge heart and has been charitable in the ways that she can be. Yeah, I mean, totally, it aligns in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I see from my own child that spirit as well. So, yeah.
Maybe rephrase this. There seems to be a sense of justice in making the world a better place for others around you and for yourself. Where do you think that comes from?
I ask myself that often. I think in part it comes from my own experiences of, like I said, things coming very full circle for me in the way that, you know, I'm very conscious of how, as I was coming through high school and through college, the people who helped me, the people who believed in me, believed in that I had something to offer, and I feel very compelled to keep that going and to return that and to believe in people who, you know, sometimes there's no one else believing in them or believing them or willing to not judge them and to just help and be helpful. So I've had people like that in my life, and I've feel compelled to be that person as well. I think I get a sense of justice from just being a mother. I think there's a natural sense of justice that just comes from having a child and, like, wanting the world to be a better place for your child. And then otherwise, I think, I don't know, I think I'm just born that way. I think I'm just, I just have a spirit of, like, I can't not, you know, help and do my part. I just, like, can't see it any other way. So,
before we move into visioning the future, tell me about the return of art and creativity of storytelling, and especially this aspect of time travel. Yeah. How did that come back into your life and become a part of it?
A lot of ways. So I think everything sort of happened synchronistically for me. So I, in law school, so, like I said, I've always been interested in time travel and in storytelling and things like that. But I think in part what happened in me going to college and also gaining this awareness of self and this identity of self, as a, my identity, affirming my identity as a Black woman in a world that is hostile to my existence, I became aware of what I was ingesting media-wise. So when I was in college and when I was taking these classes, I became aware that, like, the time travel stuff that I loved was very problematic, actually, or, like, The Matrix is very problematic. My favorite movie in the whole entire world is very problematic in a lot of ways. You know, so I started to become aware of this thing that I had loved all of my life being problematic and being having these nuances that I had never needed to be aware of. And so I rejected science fiction for a long time during that time and just didn't deal with it and didn't really, like I said, want to engage in this creative way because I really was taking on a more realistic, like, what is the world? What does it mean to me? What does it mean to my existence? That was what I was thinking about. And so I was actually into philosophy a lot more at that time than anything. And, like, existentialism and all those sorts of things. then I went to law school and met a friend, and she gave me a copy of, one day she, you know, she just kind of knew about my background and what I was interested in before, and handed me a copy of Octavia Butler's Kindred, and that was it. That was like, that was like some, like a rebirth of sorts for me, to understand, one, that there are other black people in the world who are interested in science fiction, contrary to all of the things that I've been told all my life about it being weird, about it being white, about it being this and that. Two, that it is possible for a black woman to be a protagonist in a science fiction novel, and that black people, it is possible for us to survive in the future, contrary to what media, television, science fiction has told me all of my life. It is possible for us to survive in the future. And Octavia Butler's book gave me all of that, and it was about time travel, and it was everything that I could ever dream of. And so from there, I read all of her work, and then I was, and it's so interesting, I say this all the time when I talk about this, that, like, the internet was around. It's not like there was no internet, and I, but nothing prompted me to ever look up other black science fiction creators, because it was so set in my mind that this was not for us. And I just, that is profound to me that I didn't even search for it, because I already figured it was foreclosed to us as a possibility. So anyway, so I got more into her work. I was still in law school, so there was just no way I could start doing anything creative until I got out of law school. But I started reading more of her work, and then from there found other black science fiction writers, and then just happened upon this whole community of black science fiction creators, not just writers, but people who create other art, all of these things.
Where was this community? In Philly?
No, online. Mm-hmm. There's this website called blacksciencefictionsociety.com, which is like the Facebook of black science fiction. And so I joined that website, found all of these folks. And also in Philly, which is another part of the story, is that, I'm sorry, I have to go get my partner at 6:30. Mm-hmm. Bring it up. So when I got out of law school, and like I said, I had come across Octavia Butler. I was really excited about getting back into science fiction. You know, I was graduating law school. I had my job set up for me. So I felt like I had a little bit more space to engage in creative stuff and leisure reading and things like that. And so I started, this is stupid, but I started taking writing classes at community college right after I graduated law school.
I couldn't.
And also started going to like science fiction conventions, PhilCon, and all this other stuff. And that made me even more aware of my filling out a place in traditional science fiction worlds and spaces. And so I would go to these PhilCons and these conventions and be pretty much the only black person in the room, or like these writing workshops, and just, you know, they would totally rip my story apart because it wasn't written in these traditional ways, or I didn't have these traditional characters. So it was very, very discouraging for me, and I stopped going to those things, but I started writing my own work. And eventually, it led me to want a platform to share my own work, because I didn't feel that there was a community here that I could be involved in where I could share this work, even though there was like this amazing spoken word community here, which I started going to their events, and all these other like sort of different underground arts communities, but I didn't feel I had, they were like exactly a right fit for the work I wanted to share with people. So I started my own thing. I started my organization, the Afrofuturist Affair, which started off as one event, basically just a stage and a platform for other, you know, I had met other black science fiction creators and Afrofuturists here in Philadelphia once. And it's like, sometimes you need a language, you know, for things before things can come together, even though people exist in their separate silos and pockets and we're all doing the same thing. But if you don't have that common language to come together around, you're not doing anything. And so I feel like Afrofuturism was that common language. It was, prior to me starting my organization, it was kind of an underground term, academic, not underground, more so it existed in the world of academia more so than anything. There weren't like many Afrofuturism themed events, but you know, it was more a tool of analysis for people to like say, oh, this person makes this genre of music. But I saw it more as a practice and something you could live and something that could activate people and something that should not have just been exclusive to people who had internet access and access to an academic institution. And so I started the Afrofuturist Affair not only to provide a platform for my own work and for other folks, but to bridge this divide between this like notion of Afrofuturism, which I see as super expansive, of like, you know, at its most basic, it's Black people surviving into the future again, and positively, like creating, having agency in this future, not just surviving in it, thriving in it, having agency in this future, which, you know, for the people I was serving at Community Legal Services, like, that is the idea, that's like the holy grail of ideals that people need to be working with in order to not just get out of their current situation, but again, to be able to thrive into the future. And so I started thinking about ways to connect Afrofuturism and that world and that language to what I was doing as an attorney. And it's taken me many years. I'm just now getting to the point where I've found sort of a comfortable place with the Community Futures Lab project of how I bridge those two things. But that's been the work for the past couple years of that. So I have to run downstairs and get my partner. I'll bring her up.
Okay, I'll pause her right now.
Yes.
All right, we're back. All right, so we've brought together the work world and the visioning world with Community Feature Lab. Can you tell me just a little bit about what that is for you before we make this our own featuring?
Sure, yeah. So Community Futures Lab is actually a project that my partner and I started. So my partner and I have a art collective called Black Quantum Futurism, which is sort of an interdisciplinary art practice that includes my writing, her writing, she's also a musician, and some other stuff. But so Community Futures Lab came out of that, and it is a project that is focused in the Sharswood neighborhood of North Philadelphia, which last year went through a massive eminent domain process where 1,300 properties were taken through eminent domain. And through that process, about 100 or so families were displaced. Technically, the term is they were relocated. And then another 400 or so families were relocated. I say displaced, but they say relocated, to other parts of the city as they destroyed two housing project towers and a bunch of low rises in that area. And so I, through my position at Community Legal Services, represented a lot of those folks in making sure that they were relocated safely and also would have the opportunity to come back to the neighborhood once it was redeveloped. But beyond that, I also live in the community about 10 blocks from Sharswood, and was also very much tuned into the narrative that was playing out around why this was happening, why people were being displaced. And a lot of the narrative was very negative. Basically this poverty narrative of people being to blame for their circumstances. And, you know, this narrative around essentially people being violent animals in that area and that they essentially needed to erase and start over. And that obviously is one side of the story, and not the side of the story of the people who actually live there. And so the Community Futures Lab was, one, an attempt to give people an opportunity to tell their own stories and their own narratives about that community, a community that many people had lived in all their lives, or many decades, a community that has a lot of really amazing art and music history, a community that presently has a lot of really amazing artists and musicians, a community of people who really care about their neighborhood and care about where they live and care about their neighbors, but so much of that narrative was missing and absent from what was being told about that community. And so the Community Futures Lab was an attempt to allow people to tell their own stories and to envision what they wanted to see come to that community, and not just have to deal with and live with what is given to them or forced upon them. And part of that also came out of, again, me observing how everything was playing out from my perspective as an attorney, but also my perspective as a community, nearby community member. And just, it was just really terrible. And people expressing, you know, it wasn't just me seeing this and saying, oh, I need to do something, but people just literally verbalizing how villainized and victimized they felt by these narratives. And so anyway, so it was in part of that, and we developed this idea of oral futures as a way to have people speak into existence and envision the futures that they want to see for themselves and their communities, and to create how they can have a role in creating that future. And so to that end, we also included, we opened a physical space for a year and included a series of housing futures workshops where we presented different topics around people's housing rights and other legal rights connected to housing, as well as collected these oral history and oral futures through art making events, so that it wasn't just gathering these stories through interviews, but also gathering stories through things that people make, through writing, through photos, through things that people contributed to the project. And the other part of it was to document the redevelopment as a way to hold the relevant authorities and the city accountable for what they said that they were going to do, and to have proof if they do or if they don't, and as well as to build what we call a quantum time capsule, which is essentially the project archives, but archives that are accessible to the community perpetually, not something that's locked away in a university or online or, you know, necessarily, or places that people can't access. But it's also a living archive that people can add to at any point, take from, you know, all of those things. So that's the idea behind the Community Futures Lab. We no longer have the physical space because we only had it for a year, and only had funding to do it for a year. However, through the relationships that we built with the community through this project, we are still operating a modified version of it out of the offices of the local neighborhood advisory council.
It works amazing.
Thanks. Thank you.
Tell me about what oral futures are.
So oral futures, as we define it, is essentially sort of excavating future memory, people's future memories, memories that haven't played out yet but exist in the realm of possibility. We see it, so again, our practice around Black quantum futurism sort of sees time as quantum, in a sense, in that it does not just work linearly. It's not something that just moves forward into the future. Sometimes it moves backwards. Sometimes it moves cyclically. And so taking that into account in the different ways that we view time, and people's subjective experiences of time, We thought it was important to bring this future dimension into these interviews and not have people just be focused on history and past, which is equally important. But we see sort of the past as informing the future and as operating sort of on the same, in the same domain as the future and as the present. And so we wanted to just make sure that we had all of those different dimensions represented, because the project in many, many ways is about time and temporality and how people experience time, and you can't get at that with just focusing on the past. And we also wanted to think about, you know, part of it is sort of an ethnography on how communities form time, how communities create time together, how individual temporality and individual time builds up into communal time. So we needed the oral futures to be able to answer some of those questions or think about some of those questions. We really needed to interrogate people's visions of the future, and to understand how those visions get activated and not just put away somewhere and whatever, you know, for posterity or whatever. So
that I've heard some of these ideas, just mostly through the website, through the Black Film Futures, the Afro Futures Fair website, and reading articles here and there about the Communities Futures Lab, and that is absolutely what is the idea behind this existing project on energy futures. So maybe this is a time that we can try to activate the visions of your future for Philadelphia, especially in terms of energy use.
Sure.
Does that sound good? To make that transition, I'll ask a couple of just abstract questions. The first one is, what are some things that you value most and that you love?
Things that I value, I think being involved with the Community Futures Lab project over the past year or two has really increased my notion of the value of community. You know, I feel like prior to that project, I thought of community in this very abstract way and this very, like, fluid way, which I still do and which I still think is necessary, but having my own, like, structured, dedicated community that I return to and find myself committed to and getting to know those people, like, I am, like, literally energized when I go to a community meeting. Like, after a community meeting, it doesn't even have to be, like, it could be a meeting where people are just yelling at each other for an hour, and it's amazing. Like, it's amazing to me, and I feel so good after I leave those meetings. So, like, the value of community is just, it's invaluable. I mean, it's, so that's one of the things that I'm valuing more and more that I can't say 3 years ago that I felt that way. Like, I didn't know my neighbors. I didn't know anybody from my neighborhood, really. Even though I was a homeowner, you know, I'm a homeowner in my community. So that has, yeah. Other things that I value justice and fairness. I value comfort and whatever that means to people, you know, for themselves, but I know what it means for me. I value, are you talking about, like, principles or, like, kind of just whatever?
Whatever. Things that you love, things that you value.
Yeah.
Those are for you to figure out what to tell me.
I love science and science fiction. Mm-hmm. I love thinking about things. I love, I love the pursuit of truth, you know, which is also something that is not fixed or defined, which makes it sometimes feel futile, but I still value the pursuit, you know. Yeah, I think that's it.
What are some of the things that you fear, things that are most scary to you?
I guess I fear... I also fear science. I fear government. I fear... I fear things like what the effects of cognitive dissonance and how that affects other people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, what are you thinking when you say that?
I think I just fear that things like racism, for example, and the effects of racism are not a matter of rationalization or a matter of just explaining something to someone and saying and trying to reason with people. I fear that reason is never going to help people who have convinced or who are convinced that things like racism is okay or what, you know. I just fear people's whose minds can't be changed, and I think that's more people than we want to believe at times. I fear the thermodynamic arrow of time.
Tell me what that means.
The process that the scientific process that says that time is linear, or that attempts to confirm the linearity of time, and that everything is spiraling into chaos, and that there is no, we can't get back to order. I don't believe that, but I fear that that is the belief, and so that informs our reality and how we think we can move through reality.
So fearing the idea of the heat, the entropy and the
yes.
heat death of the universe,
yes.
and that being a mythic narrative that holds people back.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
What are things that make you hopeful?
Children. My child. Community. Elders. I think those things.
People.
People. My job. People. Good people. Good people make me hopeful. And imagination and creativity makes me feel hope. That people are creative and people will be able to find a way forward with that creativity.
When you think of the word energy, what comes to mind?
Power, work, action, molecules bouncing around quickly.
And if someone was to say, how do you use energy in your life? How would you answer that?
In every way possible. I use it to live, to eat, to see, to work, to move. I use it metaphorically to mean, to represent my level of, I don't know, I use it in so many ways, honestly. Don't just use it in sort of the physical sense, but there's this energy that kind of means spirit, I guess, in a sense, or maybe that's I don't know if that comes close to what I mean, but it comes close enough, yeah.
Let's move forward into the three visioning sections here. The first one is 50 years in the future, so this is the year 2067. Of course, all sorts of visions about what climate change, how rapidly it might be moving, but 50 years in the future is not too far off, right? And 50 years in the past was socially a very different time, but also a really amazing time, 1967, right? Movie tickets cost $1.25,
right.
But the social scene in the United States was just electric, right? So 50 years from now, how do you see Philadelphia, and what's the energy story in Philadelphia?
Years from now, I mean, there's two sort of visions in my mind. One is a natural progression from where we are today, which is that we have succeeded somewhat in having better sources of energy. We're not so wasteful. The environment is not so polluted. We have clean water. There's no lead in our waters. That's my hopeful vision. And I say it's a natural progression because of the work that I'm engaged in and my colleagues and knowing what they're working on, and then also sort of the government that we have today, the mayor that we have today, who is sort of concerned about these things and dedicated to working on them. And, so if we have these folks, these kind of folks around, I think we'll be okay. The other vision is not so good, but honestly, it's not too far off from where we are now. I sort of see things, Philadelphia as more segregated, more air pollution, energy costs are through the roof and no one can afford it, and so poverty is deeper. I could see us going there too, especially with our federal government, and who knows what havoc they're going to wreak in the next couple of years that will spin us off of whatever success we've been able to gain in the past couple years. So I both of those visions are equally possible in my mind.
You're in a quantum moment there, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, a superposition where it could collapse on one or the other, but I don't see a world dramatically different either way, either improved or not improved. I don't see it as dramatically different. I don't see flying cars. I don't see those sorts of things happening. Not 50 years, at least.
In this 50-year future, where are the energy sources coming from? If now most of the energy is coming from either coal or from natural gas, which are still fossil fuels and still putting carbon that's into the atmosphere that's generating climate change and making it faster and longer, where is energy coming from in either of these futures that you're foreseeing?
In the 50-year future, same sources. I would like to say that we've gotten smarter, but I just don't think that's enough time for us to get that much smarter. Although I feel like more change happens now in a shorter period of time, physical change can happen, but like attitudes and people don't change that much, honestly. I don't see that we've progressed that much and that we're using radically different things than we use now.
Pretty similar.
At least not 50 years. Yeah.
Well, let's move forward then and see how things might change into the year 2140. So about 123, almost 125 years in the future. 123 years in the past was the year 1894. Right? So coal had just become more of a dominant energy source. Oil still wasn't really in the picture. Natural gas, certainly not in the picture, at least in terms of our energy use. Long before cars became common, before paved roads were a deep commonality in the United States, at least. So if we're going to take from now a leap to the year 2140 in Philadelphia, what does Philadelphia feel like? What does it look like?
So I think in the year 2140, I believe that at that point quantum technology will be more of a thing, will be more common, and I think along with quantum technology, hopefully our perspective on the world has shifted from us being mostly binary thinkers and doers and into quantum thinkers and more of a quantum outlook on the world. And when you have a quantum outlook on the world, your possibilities open up immensely. And so I would think that with quantum technology, we will have better opportunities to have other types of energy sources, because someone will have discovered something quantum.
Imagine one for me. What is that energy source like?
I don't know. I mean,
does it look like a big shiny metal thing? Is it in somebody's house? Is it something?
No, it? I think when we talk quantum, we're talking smaller. So I'm hoping it is not. I don't think it's a big shiny thing. I don't think it's a big thing with smoke coming out of it. I think it's more quantum. It's something small. It's something you're doing at some atomic level that may not have any emissions or have any visible output, but you know, it's working at the quantum level. I can see that.
Are they in people's does everyone have them, or is it in a centralized system?
Good question. Well, communist in me believes it's something more central and communal. But I could also see, I think in this quantum world, 123 years from now, we're more communal. We realize that the individualized bootstrapping model of life and existence and everything that we do is doesn't work, and we're more back into communal living. Maybe it's something that's more centralized, not in people's homes, because it's not necessary. But then again, if the climate is as messed up as it probably will be, it may be something where we're like in pods and we have our own energy sources. But I don't want that future.
I like
the idea of communal.
How are people moving around?
Not cars, not flying cars. I am very much, sort of thinking about like Kindred, for example, Octavia Butler's novel, where the protagonist travels back in time into the antebellum South as a black woman. And she understands that the technology that she brings into the past from the future is not going to work for her. Like, it's not, there's no way you can walk around as a black woman who's supposed to be a slave with some technology that wouldn't make sense for all different sorts of reasons, and not because you're going to break the fabric of space-time, but because you'll die, you know. So I think in terms of that, like, just that relying on technology that is not far future technology, but that is past technology, but like it's relative in terms of like its technological ability or whatever. I think a reversion back to like more past ways of living and communal living is my vision of the future, not a shiny post-apocalyptic silver jumpsuit future where we're riding around and whatever. We're walking. We're using our bodies as technology, but not in a way that strains or taxes us. Because I always think about like, how did my ancestors walk from fucking the South to, you know, how did that happen? And I can't even walk like two blocks without getting winded. So just thinking about like how we adapt ourselves to get back to a point where we can walk long distances and it works out, and that's our main way of, you know, or these sorts of things. So I don't see cars necessarily, but maybe something with wheels, but not cars.
What about food energy?
Yeah, I guess I would give the same answer. I think at a point it's going to be necessary to go back and to think about the old ways of doing things and seeing technology as relative. But also I think about, you know, I occasionally read historical stuff, and like, things weren't that great back then either in terms of food and stuff. I was reading this one thing about how during the French Revolution, there's this theory or this correlation between like the bread being poisoned and moldy and like it having some like LSD type effect that potentially was why everybody went crazy during the French Revolution. So just things like that worry me. But yeah, I mean, like we can't clone food. I don't want that future where we're cloning food or where we're GSLOs. I don't know about all that stuff too much, but I don't want that future. I don't want a future of fast food restaurants. And even like now, for myself, like I think about how difficult it is to like cook every night and things like that. And how like more and more I'm relying on Uber Eats, which is just not good. Like, that's not a future I want. That's not a future I'm happy about moving into. More like, I guess, growing our own food. More understanding of how food works and impacts our bodies. And the importance of that, because I feel like that's something I never really learned too well. I mean, you know, everybody's had health class, but, you know, besides the food pyramid, I really don't know too much about food, to be honest, except what I like to eat and what tastes good. So I think a future where we are just as knowledgeable about food as anything else and the different impacts it has on our bodies, and so that we can eat for energy and eat to be able to do and not just eat for pleasure or for taste, which is where I'm at in my life. So.
Is Philadelphia getting bigger or smaller? Or is
in
it the same?
In the future, maybe smaller. As people run away from cities. I think
people will flee Philadelphia.
Yeah, I see that. But then again, I sort of see Philly as, I mean, they call it a sanctuary city, but I do see it has its issues, but I do see it sort of as a freedom, like something about it feels a little free for me. And I, you know, if we're in a future where, you know, a sort of post-apocalyptic future that I hope we don't go into, I see Philly as continuing to have that status where it's a sanctuary in spite of, you know, and amongst other places. I think that energy is here, that freedom spirit is here, and I think that will last.
So 300 years into the future, or about, we're going to go to the year 2312.
Okay.
That same amount of time in the past was the year 1722. So Philadelphia still existed. It already was around then, but it was only about 40 years old.
Right.
And there was a whole lot that was going to happen in terms of oppression, in terms of colonization, in terms of science and technology, and communal development that happens in that 300-year period. So if we take from Philadelphia today and move forward 300 years, what's Philadelphia like, and what's the energy in Philly then? In the year 2312.
300 years from now, I don't know if there is a Philly. I don't know if there's an America.
Okay. Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
300 years in the future, there may not be Philadelphia, there may not be the United States.
Yeah, Mother Nature has more than likely reclaimed her ground. Yeah, so Philadelphia is just grass and wild animals roaming around. That's one feature. The other feature, part of my science fiction brain is like, actually nothing at all has changed. We're actually in some weird static present that continues to look the same way it is, and actually no one dies, and we're just here forever, stuck with each other, replaying the same timeline again and again. But that's some weird conspiracy path. So it's either Mother Nature has reclaimed us, or we're sort of stuck in the same present moment. And also in this 300 years from now, time is defined differently, so we may not even be in the year 20 something. Maybe we have reset because everything is out of control and people have realized that time doesn't actually exist in the way that we thought it did. So time is not a thing in this future. Yeah, we might be stuck in the present moment. And so everything kind of looks the same and nothing has really changed so much.
Yeah. Awesome.
It's not very hopeful, but that's what I'm getting from 300 years from now.
I see it. Do you have anything else to add about the vision of the future and what you think Philadelphia's future will be, especially in terms of energy and climate change?
I hope that the future will bring clarity and understanding around how environmental racism, what it is and how it is, and how climate change and other environmental issues especially impact communities of color, who already are impacted by so many things. And so when we think about things like health and happiness and stability and housing, we very, very rarely think about how the environment plays a role in that. For the future, I see more awareness around these things, and this conversation being a part of these other conversations, and these other movements and actions around health, housing, safety, the ability to exist comfortably. I see a future where that conversation is on par with these other conversations and a part of them, because I think we can no longer afford to silo these issues. We're seeing our abject failure of what happens when we silo these issues. They just get worse and worse, and sort of excluding people of color, black people, from these conversations, whether intentionally or not, is a mistake, because we are literally dying from environmental issues and we don't think of them as our issues, you know, generally speaking. Of course I can't speak for everyone, but we just don't think of them as our issues. We think of, you know, environment as something out there and not something here that we're in and around us. And so I see a future where that conversation is different and people understand the importance of environment because it is all we have, almost literally, you know.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your
time today. Of course. It's fun.